Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Our current times are so often compared quite aptly to the Industrial Revolution, when changes in technology had a profound and lasting effect on people, on economies, on whole cultures. The digital revolution is not only causing massive disruption to industries, but it's changing the way we communicate, it's changing the way we see ourselves, it changes the way we see others. Prominent author and Christian thinker Andy Crouch says that these revolutionary moments are challenging the very nature of personhood. When it comes to contemporary thought about living well as Christians in our society, Andy Crouch is an influential voice. He's a great thinker and he's one of my favourite authors. He's been the supervising editor of Christianity Today. He's a journalist, he's a musician, and the partner for theology and culture at Praxis. He's authored several books, one of which, Culture Making, has been influential in shaping my own approach to this program. Now, Andy Crouch is part of a growing movement of thinkers who believe the Christian church, Christians generally in fact, can contribute to human flourishing by thinking and acting redemptively. That is, working to restore human dignity in a way that reflects the values of the kingdom of God and the truth of what Jesus did on the cross. Last week, I was absolutely thrilled to sit down with Andy Crouch on the sidelines of the Q Ideas Conference in Nashville, where he was one of the speakers. We talked about the next revolution, the biological revolution, how that will profoundly challenge personhood in a way not previously challenged, how Christians ought to respond, and also listen out as he talks about his favourite book in the Bible. It's probably not one that you would have thought of.
You can think of the modern world as built on a series of revolutions. The most well-known is the Industrial Revolution, where work changes from being done by human beings and animals to being done by engines, right? And actually, one that came before that was the Financial Revolution, where wealth shifted from land to money, and we were able to kind of liberate wealth from land and just pass it around in the form of notes and bills and coins, and now just symbols in computational systems. But the next revolution is the biological revolution. And in this revolution, we'll be able to make human life without having to beget human life. So human beings have always been begotten. That is, two people have the most intimate experience possible in some ways for human beings. And out of that experience, ideally in the context of love and commitment, comes a new life. And a new life that is not just a copy of either parent. This is kind of the genius, in a way, of sexual reproduction, is that it combines two different human genetic codes in a way that produces a completely new person. But we will have the option to make human beings who are copies and to make them without personal encounter. And all these revolutions, in a way, are a turn away from the personal. But the biological revolution, in which life will be made rather than begotten, is maybe the furthest step yet in removing personhood from the most fundamental facts of human life.
Of course, most of that technology now exists, and the only thing standing between what we do now, which is not clone human beings, not engineer them, and doing those things, is in fact some kind of moral code that's written into our social structures. And yet, that moral code, as everybody knows, is constantly under challenge and quite frankly, is morphing in the direction of the revolution to come.
Completely. And in fact, I think it's very likely that cloning of human beings, and it's not just cloning, it's a number of other technologies that in various ways can tailor newly formed human embryos for whatever purposes we may need them. This will probably happen first outside of the West, because the West has inherited a Christian moral vision that put limits on that, as you say. But there are other technologically advanced societies now that really don't share in that Christian inheritance at all. And they see what is in fact the case, that there are tremendous economic and even in a certain sense health benefits to be reaped from being able to actually manufacture and manage human life in this way. So the challenge is going to be that the Chinese or perhaps the Koreans will leapfrog the West or the post-Christendom world with this technology will start to have tremendous power available to them. And it's already the case that our own institutions in the United States and Australia and the kind of Commonwealth, that we feel this pressure to catch up with what's happening in China and Korea. And that will only become more powerful. And the question is whether we will have any moral vision that would restrain what we could do. Because as you say, all of this we can do today if we chose to do it.
Now, you made a very powerful point that these types of revolutions have happened before in history. You've pointed back to the Roman Empire.
Yes, that's right. So, interestingly, we're not the first ones to have a financial revolution. That happened with the invention of coinage in Rome that actually created a whole new kind of wealth that didn't exist before. And they had engineering at an amazing level. And in a way, I kind of think we are still living in the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was so dominant. Of course, there were parallel things happening, for example, in China over several thousand years. But in the West, and in a certain way, through industrialization for the whole world, we're still living with the dream of the Romans. And it was also a very impersonal empire at its height. That is, most people were not recognized as persons legally and socially and civilly. And it was a terrible place to be an ordinary person. It was an amazing place to be a very privileged person for its time.
Well, and this is a very interesting point. So you also had what we're going through at the moment, the depersonalization of knowledge.
Yes.
So knowledge moves from wisdom, something that I can pass on to you or you can pass on to me, moreover, to something that's stored in the cloud, probably on Wikipedia. Now, the same thing happened in Rome, as you've pointed out.
Yeah.
This was knowledge going into libraries.
Yes.
And out of that came well-known thinkers that we could all talk about at length, well-known philosophers whose work remains to this very day. And yet, this issue of personhood is central to the kind of moral change and really the answer for humanity. Our guest is Andy Crouch on Open House. This is your new thesis. To get there, talk to us about how impersonal it was in Rome. Would I have been likely to have known you if I was a noble person and you were a slave, for instance?
Well, certainly Rome, like all complex societies, had lots of interactions between human beings. And if I were a slave and you were a noble, I might well have gone into your home on the behalf of my master, the paterfamilias of my household. And there would have been lots of interaction, but it was carried out in a highly stratified way that did not recognize the personhood of most people. So before the law, only the nobles would have had any access to law. And of course, you mentioned the libraries. I mean, some Roman libraries had 60,000 volumes, private libraries. I mean, quite extraordinary. But those were only accessible to a very small fraction of the population. Now, in our world, we have in one way much more egalitarian distribution of many good things, especially in advanced societies. Almost everyone, especially outside of my own country, has access to healthcare, for example. And everyone, almost everyone, to a first approximation, can read. But what's going to happen, I think, in our time is a more subtle kind of robbing of people of the capacity they're meant to have. And that it's less coercive, like it's less preventing people from reading, and it's more simply that the entertainment options and to some extent the drug options that are going to become available will just mean that many people will not choose to develop themselves as human beings and to develop their personhood. And we already, at least in the U.S., which is the only context I know well, have a kind of two-track society where, despite our nominal egalitarianism, the reality is that some people have tremendous scope for personhood and agency, and many other people feel very excluded. And this is just going to, this divide will continue to widen as these revolutions kind of play themselves out more deeply.
And in fact, fragment people even more. So there might be a two-track society, may I suggest to you, with respect, there's probably an 8 or 10 track.
Yeah.
And if you think about the complexity of our country, where you've got everybody from Syrian refugees coming in through to our indigenous people who we still don't understand and deal with in an appropriate way, through to rich poor, the gap getting bigger. So we're fragmenting, and yet the most powerful thing is to be able to know you. And for me as an individual, the most powerful thing is to be known by somebody else in multiple contexts.
Yes. And this is the astonishing thing about the first Christians, is that they created those bonds of knowledge and of face-to-face personal recognition and honoring one another as persons. They used family language, brother and sister. I mean, this is quite radical in its time. It's just not the way people talked at all. Now, we're, those of us in the English-speaking world are on the other side of this story. And so, you know, even our language of civil rights, at least in the United States, politicians all the time talk about family and brother and sister without recognizing that that was absolutely inconceivable when the first Christians said that a slave was a brother to his former master, which Paul says in the letter to Philemon. So the Christians created a kind of parallel society driven by a parallel story, a different kind of story, that in the midst of the impersonal or depersonalizing world of Rome, restored personhood to anyone, no matter who they were, high, low, Greek, Jew, slave, free. And that society was so compelling that people started to opt in. There's a fascinating book that's been very influential on me by an American Mennonite historian called The Patient Ferment of the Early Church by Alan Kreider. And Alan Kreider observes that the early church actually did not evangelize in the way that we often think of, that is, trying to persuade people to become Christians. We have no record of that at all. But instead what happened is that people simply observed this new society in their midst who related to each other in a new way, and they wanted to be part of it because it was a place they would be treated as fully human.
And why not? That takes us to what you've described this week as your favorite verse in the Bible. It's not John 3:16.
No, it's not. In fact, I can't tell you the exact verse number, but it's in the 16th chapter of the letter to the Romans. And it's towards the end of that chapter when the scribe, who's been taking down dictation for the whole letter, writes this down. He says, "I, Tertius," that's his name, "who wrote this letter, greet you in the Lord." And this is it's not entirely unprecedented in Greco-Roman letter writing for a scribe to insert his own language. In fact, there's a famous correspondence in which a Roman noble complains that the slave of another noble keeps saying hello to his slaves in his letters. He says, let him write his own letter. So it sometimes would happen, but it was treated as an object of kind of scorn and mockery. But here's this man who may be a slave, he might be free, but he's low status. He's a scribe. He's just taking dictation. And the Apostle Paul, who has just dictated the letter to the Romans, the theological high watermark in some ways of the New Testament, says, "Tertius, you should greet the church in Rome." Maybe Tertius knows some of them. Maybe he has a relationship with them. And this is a moment of humanization and repersoning, I almost want to say, of Tertius, whose name, by the way, literally just means third, number three. He didn't even have a given name the way that you or I have. Yeah. His mother, or perhaps the paterfamilias of the home in which he was born, just named him number three. And number three is seen as a person and is asked to himself greet his brothers and sisters in Rome.
So this is your favorite verse in the Bible because why?
I think because it's so unexpected and it shows how radically the gospel is going to transform society. It's like the first little shoot of a plant growing up. It's a seed in the barren Roman world, such a depersonalizing world, of a new way of seeing people. So I would call Romans 16 the most sociologically significant chapter in the Bible. Now, you know, sociology being the study of human societies and structures and how they change over time, and often how they're stratified and how we're separated from one another. And Romans 16, which is this long list of greetings to all different people of different stations, men and women, another astonishing thing in the context of the ancient world, all being treated with dignity and respect. And that's up and running, in a sense, already, just a decade or two after Jesus' resurrection. And then you think about that playing itself out over the next, well, hundreds of years, with many fits and starts and many false turns and reverses. But this vision of the dignity of persons, no matter who you are, even if you were given a name like number three, you are of great value. This will be important, by the way, once we have human beings who don't have mothers and fathers and who don't have families and who are manufactured through various processes, presumably. What community will treat them as fully human? The overwhelming temptation will be to treat them as a second class of citizens, and in a sense, a new slave class made for our own use. But the Christian community, if we live up to our calling, will treat them just as we treat our own children and our own brother, our fleshly, our physical brothers and sisters, and will treat them as children of God and as our brothers and sisters.
Andy Crouch is our guest on Open House. You've shown us, on the basis of the past, something that we might expect for the future. And you've also shown us that issues that we take for granted, freedoms that we take for granted in around the world, the freedom of all people, the equality of men and women, and so on, are deeply Christian notions that we introduced, that the Christian Church introduced to the world. I wonder, though, why we're not seen for that as a church. Why are we not known for those things? Because we certainly seem to be known for judgment and condemnation.
Well, we're not known for that rich and wonderful legacy because there's another legacy, which is the legacy of cooperation with empire. So, of course, Romans 16 happens at a moment when no Christian could imagine that the emperor himself would be a Christian. But when Constantine converts, the church understandably sees that as a wonderful moment for the gospel, the relief of persecution, the opportunity to spread the gospel. But over the ensuing centuries, of course, we end up complicit in all kinds of ways with ideologies that do not take their cues from the life and ministry of Jesus. And so the church became entangled with the empire's way of doing things. And I just think we have to be very honest about that. I would add that then when we started to have our alliance with the empire, as it were, taken away, that is when Christendom started to end, and Christians lost the kind of cultural power that we had had, we became very resentful and disappointed that it had been taken away. And I think some of that judgmentalism that you refer to is the result of a kind of loss of cultural power that we once took for granted, that probably we never should have taken for granted. but that having had it, we really came to love it. And having lost it, we really resent those who took it away. And this produces a kind of anger in public life that is the second layer of the legacy. And it's why this most beautiful part of our history is kind of buried under first a layer of imperial complicity and then a layer of kind of frustration at our lack of cultural power. But the first Christians had none of that cultural power, and yet they lived so creatively. And that's what we could do.
I want to come to what we can do in a moment. But before I do that, will you permit me to ask you a question about your country, where evangelical Christians now many of them are torn about what's happening in the White House, but certainly helped to put Donald Trump into the White House, and probably as a result feel that they're getting, some of them, that they're getting great results, Supreme Court judges and overturning certain other decisions and so on. Is that an example of getting too close to empire?
I think without a doubt that the handful of self-styled evangelical leaders who have kept themselves very close to our president, our current president, I certainly would see as very unwisely aligning themselves with someone who has in no way has, in the long run, Christian interests at heart, or the interests of the common good at heart, which is really what Christians should be about. We should be about the common good, not just our own private or narrow interests. But it is the case that a significant majority of people who call themselves evangelical Christians not only voted for Donald Trump, but support Donald Trump today in polls. They're his strongest polling group in a country that largely does not approve of him. This is a group that approve of him. And I am not one of those people. There are many evangelical leaders who are not. And as you say, some are conflicted. I would say far less are conflicted than you might hope. But one also has to remember, I think, two layers. One is this two-track society. There is evangelical Christian in the United States can describe a lot of different kinds of people, but it does apply to the largely white, disproportionately rural communities who feel most left out of our kind of late modern progress. And maybe most to the point, they feel a kind of cultural scorn and humiliation from the elites of the coasts. And I live on one of the coasts of the US, and I'm one of those elites. And I know that even just at levels of dialect and language, let alone kind of cultural choices, that people who don't speak with the right accent and who just have had different experiences and options in their lives than the cosmopolitan elites feel this tremendous scorn. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump promised to honor them and to treat them as fully human, honestly. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think they should trust him for a moment. And yet, sometimes it's just enough to be told that you matter when everyone else is treating you with scorn. So that's kind of the cultural backdrop. But then the religious backdrop is that, unfortunately, our Democratic Party, the elites within it, not so much the rank and file and not even so much the elected officials, but the people who actually run things behind the scenes. We got glimpses of this in the leaks of email that came out from the illicit email server that candidate Clinton or Secretary of State Clinton had. Yeah. We learned how much scorn and contempt they had for traditional faith, not just evangelical, but Catholic, any traditional faith. So it was a very difficult choice between a party that whose whole apparatus, if it had had the opportunity to take power in 2016, would have moved to enact in legislation the contempt that they felt. And on the other hand, an utter fool in the biblical sense of the word, who cannot be trusted, but who did treat people with respect. So you have to appreciate why people stick with the one who at least does not treat them with scorn.
Well, to move to a conclusion and maybe point to hope, you're part of an organization, Praxis, that adopts a redemptive approach towards our work in the world. I wonder whether this isn't, in fact, the exact answer that we're looking for, to restore dignity to people and for Christians to restore dignity to their own sense of self within society, to work for the good of others, which, after all, was exactly what Jesus entrusted to us. So talk about a redemptive type of work. What does that look like? How should ordinary Christians be involved in that?
Yes, I have the great gift of working with entrepreneurs. That's our focus at Praxis, is people who are starting new ventures, both businesses and not nonprofit ventures. And what we are all aiming to do is not just be ethical business people. I think this has been a temptation for Christians to think, well, if I just do a kind of a good job and do it honestly and don't defraud and tell the truth and then maybe witness to Christ along the way that I've done my job. But we think actually we need something much deeper in our current cultural context. We need very imaginative efforts in every sector, like every line of business, every part of the economy, and ultimately every part of the world, that see how broken things are and then creatively restore, really, personhood, as we've talked about. And this is why we use the word of redemption, because redemption is of course comes from kind of economics, and you talk about redeeming a bond, or redeeming a coupon, or redeeming a slave. And what that means is that something's been lost or a debt has been incurred, and someone steps in and pays sometimes a very great cost to restore a kind of wholeness that was missing. That's redemption.
It's also what happened on the cross.
Oh, absolutely. That is the cross, the paying of a great price to buy back, to restore capacity that had been lost through sin. And so we're asking, what are the creative acts of sacrifice that startup ventures can make in every area, from fashion to the restaurant industry to here to at the conference where we're speaking, we had someone who's doing this in the car wash industry, like automated car washes, which are the least pleasant places in the United States in some ways. This entrepreneur is asking, how do we make a car wash a redemptive environment that encourages people to take good care of their cars, to keep their cars for longer, so that we're not just consumeristically buying a new car when the old one looks tawdry and dirty.
But also, he's redeeming the lives of his workers, isn't he?
Exactly. So it's the whole system that you're working on. So he's also thinking about, these are, you know, what we would call blue-collar jobs. But how do you make a blue-collar job, like working at a car wash, have great dignity and have a potential for real self-development and improvement? And so this is a redemptive vision. And, of course, it's what the first Christians did, just honestly, willy-nilly, without really thinking about it, just because they'd been so transformed by the gospel. And so that's really our aim as well. It's to be so transformed by the gospel that we go out, and in every sector of the economy and broader society, we are people who are creatively sacrificing so that things can be restored that have been lost.
Well, Andy Crouch, it's been an absolute delight and a privilege to speak with you. Your thinking has been very influential, actually, in shaping up many of the things behind this program, Open House, and my own approach to journalism at the moment, and indeed the approach of a number of our Christian radio stations. So thank you, and we hope to see you in Australia, you know, soon.
I certainly hope so. Thank you, Stephen, so much.
Andy Crouch, an author, a clear thinker, and the partner for theology and culture at Praxis, this organization that talks to businesses and not-for-profits about how they can, yes, do business and do work in the world, but do so in a way that's redemptive. Very, very excited to have spoken and met with Andy Crouch. We are trying to get him to Australia. You'll be among the first to know if we manage to get him. It'll be just a little while. And here's a secret. What you just heard, that part about Tertius and the Book of Romans and the way that the early church restored personhood and the similarity between our current revolutions and the revolutions in Rome, that's the subject of his next book.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.